This week on Vaticano, step inside the Jubilee's most unique holy door, located inside a Roman prison. Hear from Cardinal Mario Grech, Secretary General of the Synod of Bishops since 2020, and explore how the Pontifical Oriental Institute's digital library uses AI to foster ecumenical dialogue. Vaticano starts now. After 5 years of restoration, Archbishop of Paris, Laurent Ulrich, knocked on the doors of Notre Dame. Attendees, including the United Kingdom's Prince William, First Lady Jill Biden, Ukrainian President Zelensky, and U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, standing alongside French President Macron. Notably absent was Pope Francis, who chose to decline the invitation to the event. Many doubted that restoring a cathedral of this size and complexity within 5 years was possible. Yet Philippe Villeneuve, the chief architect overseeing the project, says his faith is what drove him to persevere.
I have a particular devotion to the Virgin Mary, and I never stopped feeling support coming from up there.
In the week before its reopening, President Emmanuel Macron inspected the work, including the new altar, the white stone, gold details, and restored bells. He was guided by Notre Dame's rector, Father Olivier Ribadeau-Dumas.
It fills me with pride, but at the same time, I'm humble because I realize the immensity of what has been done, and also the immensity of how it was built 860 years ago. And now that it has been rebuilt, the mission has been entrusted in me to bring it to life. I have to make sure it is a place of prayer, so that it is a place of celebration, and so that it is a place of discovery of faith.
When the fire broke out in 2019, Cécile Thévenin was among those who gathered by the River Seine to sing and pray.
We thought that the cathedral would crumble. Then we were praying, basically, or singing, and I discovered that at this moment, French people are deeply attached to this cathedral.
And now she hopes it will give a boost to the faith. I hope it will strengthen the faith. It's about Mary. The Catholic Church now has 21 new cardinals. On December the 7th, during the consistory for the creation of cardinals, Pope Francis urged them to remain on the path of service so that there may be no division among them, but unity.
Dove sta andando il mio cuore?
The Pope explained that the word cardinal implies being a hinge of the Church and a point of connection.
Fare la strada di Gesù.
Francis said that the mission to which cardinals are called is to encounter others along the way and heal the most fragile. After the consistory, the newly created cardinals gathered in the Apostolic Palace to greet the faithful and members of the Roman Curia. There they expressed their emotion and commitment to the mission entrusted to them by the Pope.
It is a gift and at the same time it is a responsibility. I was organizing until now the apostolic journeys, and I will continue to do that.
Some of them returned to their archdioceses with a vision of what they want to contribute to the Catholic Church.
One of the biggest needs is we need to get back to the basics in proclaiming Jesus, his gospel, in a clear way, but in a loving way, to help people come to know the person of Jesus, to belong to him, to live in him and with him.
Among them was Cardinal Bajchuk, who is now the youngest of the cardinals. At 44 years old and the only Ukrainian cardinal, he stated that his appointment is a powerful call for peace in Ukraine.
It is difficult to say what Pope had in his mind. Maybe future will open or reopen a little bit, for which reason I was nominated as a cardinal, the youngest cardinal, and especially not only for Ukrainian church or Australian church, but for the universal church. But at least there is true small light of hope in this nomination, yeah.
After the consistory, the cardinals explained that they had received their cardinal appointments with surprise, but had embraced this service to the church with great enthusiasm.
I'm sure that I will be more involved in the universal church, not only in my local church, or from my local church, I will be involved in the universal church, and I'm happy for that.
As of December the 7th, the total number of eligible cardinal electors will be 140, 110 chosen by Pope Francis. This means the current pontiff has named 79% of the men who will one day elect his successor.
Hello and welcome to this week's Vaticano Updates, the most important news from the Holy Father and the Vatican. As Notre Dame Cathedral reopens for worship 5 years after a devastating fire, Pope Francis offers solidarity, gratitude, and hope, calling it a shift from sadness and mourning to joy, celebration, and praise. He says he joins the faithful in spirit and prayer as the cathedral rises anew from its ashes. Addressed to Archbishop Laurent Ulrich of Paris, his message was read by Archbishop Celestino Migliore, the Apostolic Nuncio to France, during Saturday's inaugural ceremony. Christian leaders in Assam, northeast India, have voiced deep concern over ongoing attacks on the Christian community in the BJP-ruled state. The Assam Christian Forum, chaired by Archbishop John Mulakira of Guwahati, expressed shock and anguish at what it called relentless attacks against Christians and their institutions over the past year. "We need protection," Archbishop Mulakira said on December the 3rd, urging the government to ensure Christians' safety. On the solemnity of the Immaculate Conception, during the Sunday Angelus, Pope Francis called for peace and urged world leaders to secure ceasefires by Christmas. "I appeal to governments and the international community to achieve a ceasefire on all war fronts by the Christmas celebration," he said, speaking from the Apostolic Palace to pilgrims in St. Peter's Square. He asked for prayers for peace in Ukraine, the Middle East, especially in Palestine, Israel, Lebanon, and Syria, as well as in Myanmar, Sudan, and all places torn by violence, as he said. The Archdiocese of Liverpool has officially recognized the seventh first Lourdes miracle. After reviewing new evidence, Archbishop Malcolm McMahon confirmed a 1923 healing of World War I veteran John Tranter as miraculous. A special celebration is planned in 2025 at Liverpool's Metropolitan Cathedral to mark this historic declaration. Thank you, as always, for watching this week's Vaticano Updates in Rome. Andreas Tonhauser for EWTN Vaticano.
We'll be back after a short break with a special look at the most unique holy door of the upcoming Jubilee. The holy door at Rebibbia Prison is the only one besides St. Peter's Basilica that Pope Francis will personally open on December the 26th. This bronze door, hidden behind the high walls of the Roman prison, symbolizes not just this penitentiary, but all prisons worldwide.
When we received the news, everyone, from the head of the department to the volunteers, staff, and the inmates, have been filled with a great sense of anticipation and excitement.
This extraordinary gesture was strongly desired by the Pope himself, who emphasized it in the bowl of indiction for the Jubilee 2025, Spes non confundit. In the bowl, the Pope writes that in the Jubilee year, we are all called to be signs of hope for many brothers and sisters in hardship, especially prisoners, who endure both the harshness of confinement and emotional emptiness. The Jubilee of Hope finds its most powerful expression in the Pope's visit to the prison, a profound sign of hope for those who need it most.
The motto of the prison police is precisely related to hope, so this is certainly a moment of hope here.
Pope Francis has the ability to reach everyone's heart in a very direct and authentic way, so it will certainly be a message of closeness, of love, solidarity, but also of understanding what are the difficulties that characterize a confined community like the prison. And it's not by chance that this is the Jubilee of Hope.
This hope extends not just to the prisoners, but to everyone living and working within the prison's walls, which is often an extremely difficult and depressing experience. Father Lucio Boldrin, the chaplain of Rebibbia Prison, experiences these challenges firsthand every day.
In celle talvolta di sei persone, in posti molto ristretti.
In cells that sometimes house six people, in very cramped spaces, with ages ranging from 25 to 80. With these bunk beds, they lie there, staring at the ceiling, only listening to the television. They shut down inside. The Holy Door must really open to us so that we do not resign ourselves. Because resignation, the fear that nothing good will happen anymore. This becomes an important element of the approach, to make it clear that prisoners are human beings who may have erred to a greater or lesser degree, but they cannot be considered just numbers, and they cannot be those who are precluded from having a future, a tomorrow.
A new tomorrow is brought to life for the prisoners through initiatives like the call center, where they work as telephone operators for the Vatican Pediatric Hospital of Bambin Gesù.
You can't exclude a new tomorrow, because prisoners who don't have a tomorrow, a little bit at a time, fade away inside. I also see it, especially when they are young people sentenced for 22, 25, 30 years, or for life imprisonment. They change completely. They die inside, and that is extremely dangerous. We have continuous situations of self-harm. Self-harm is a way of shouting, I am here, I'm a person. Listen to me, give me a chance.
Ascoltatemi, datemi la possibilità.
In a special workshop called Metamorphosis, prisoners are transforming driftwood from migrant barges into pieces of art, including rosaries and a wooden nativity scene. The nativity scene will be displayed during the opening of the Holy Door.
When our prisoners found out that Pope Francis was coming to visit us for the opening of the Holy Door, they immediately became active with a disarming spontaneity in thinking of creating, of building a gift.
The piece is being crafted as a special gift for the Holy Father, to be revealed on the day the Holy Door opens. The 1,600-strong prison community, with diverse backgrounds and sentence lengths, eagerly anticipates the Pope's visit on St. Stephen's Day. Inside the church, preparations are nearly complete, with the platform for the Pope's wheelchair ready and final touches underway. The church's restored facade, with a bronze Holy Door depicting Jesus' life, stands in waiting. For the inmates, the Holy Door's opening represents more than a physical act. It's a chance to open their hearts to a new future. The event will mark the start of the Jubilee year in Rebibbia, reminding all that even in darkness, Jesus brings hope. In the aftermath of the second part of the Synod on Synodality, Andreas Thonhauser, EWTN Vatican Bureau Chief, sat down with Cardinal Mario Grech, Secretary General of the Synod of Bishops, to discuss the Synod's key outcomes and its impact on the Church's mission.
Your Eminence, what are your takeaways of the Synod on Synodality? I feel a sense of deep gratitude, appreciation, and hope. The aim of this synod is very similar to the mission of your station. No, you are committed to share the eternal word. And the aim of this assembly was and is mission, evangelization. But to fulfill this mission, we need to be more church. And this synod was, in view of mission, evangelization, a reflection on who is the church. Who are we as a church? And I think that the people of God, all the baptized, realize that they have received the Holy Spirit that empowers them to be prophetic in the world today. We will miss a great opportunity.
In a nutshell, how would you describe it, or what you heard also as a synod, what the church is?
I mean, this synod helps us to understand ourselves, to recognize our identity founded on baptism, that the church is the people, holy people of God. And when I say that we are the holy people of God, there are three important dimensions, no? The communio fidelium, the community of the faithful, the communio ecclesiarium, that is all the particular churches together, and the communio episcoporum, because the bishop is the principle that guarantees unity and truth in the church. If these three dimensions, no, really come to work together, then I think, yes, we made a step forward also considering the teaching of Lumen Gentium, of Vatican II.
So would you say also the goals that were set by your office, but I would imagine also by Pope Francis and others for the Synod, that those were achieved? And maybe what were those biggest achievements?
One simple goal. I mean, the thrust of the Synod was how to become more synodal church. Communion, participation, and mission. But then there were no other agenda. So throughout the process, we learned to walk together.
Were you surprised that Pope Francis did not give his own exhortation after the synod, but accepted the final document, the summary, so to say, into church teaching, as church teaching?
In a way, yes, I was surprised, because this is the first in the history of the Synod of Bishops, no? That the Holy Father at the end says, listen, I sign this document. I make my own this document. But at the same time, I saw it coming. And the Holy Father believes in this, believes in the sensus fidelium, no? And what he did when he decided to approve, to make his own this document, proves that he believes in the authority of the Synodal Assembly.
Your Eminence, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In a few moments, we'll be back with a tour of the Pontifical Oriental Institute, where they use AI for research and reconciliation. More on Vaticano.
What does the church say about God? Who is God? Who is Jesus? Ask a question, and you'll, in 3 seconds, five, you'll have an answer in a paragraph that can begin your own search. The church should be on the cutting edge of this, both for the students who, just people who have questions. They're 20 years old, they have a feeling about God, they never had any instruction, they want to know something pretty simple.
For millennia, knowledge has been passed down through writing, preserved in libraries as symbols of wisdom and culture. The ancient Egyptians, with their refined papyrus writing techniques, were among the first to preserve and transmit knowledge. The patriarchs of the early Christian communities and the Eastern Church continued this tradition, safeguarding sacred and philosophical texts of incalculable worth. The Pontifical Oriental Institute's use of digitization allows for the preservation and distribution of historical texts and works to go far beyond their usual reach. Andreas Thonhauser, EWTN Vatican Bureau Chief, takes us inside this incredible library.
Wow, this is really incredible. More than 200,000 books one can find here, which is really the heart of the Pontifical Oriental Institute. And the project to digitalize the most valuable and also oldest volumes that can be found here will open this treasure to the whole world.
We have two different types of scanners. The first type features a platform that moves the volume towards a glass surface for scanning. This design allows for the scanning of very large volumes. The second type is equipped with a V-shaped glass lectern that rests on the volume, making it suitable for scanning books or documents that cannot be fully opened 180 degrees.
But it is its use of artificial intelligence that is truly a game changer and puts the Vatican-affiliated university at the cutting edge of technology, as Father David Nazar explains.
It's not a big university. We have maybe 200 academic students, maybe another 150 come just for languages. And we can have as many as 400 visiting scholars in any year just for the library, because the resources are here to study. If 400 come, 4,000, 40,000 can't come. So clearly for us, there was a desire to put as many things online as we possibly could. But the resources were very weak. The software resources for doing that were weak. So out comes AI, and it answered what for us was a frustration. What they could do was translate the document into a computer language. Then AI could go to work on the document. AI also allows us to translate. So you could do a search in your native language. The document might come back in three languages. Then you could say, well, could you translate this into Hungarian so that I can understand it in my native language? And it will do that in 3 seconds. So for as a research tool, it is extraordinary. You do not have to read the equivalent of the entire Summa to find out what St. Thomas says about the nature of Jesus. You can ask the question, and you'll get a summary based on all that he has written.
Through the shared consultation of ancient texts held in the online library of the Pontifical Oriental Institute, two researchers from nations in conflict historically discovered a powerful tool for reconciliation.
A brilliant young student who came from Baghdad, and she had lived through four wars and was now very concerned for the rebuilding of her country. She was born and raised in Baghdad. One of her points was that we cannot import French or American democracy. It has to be on the genius of our own people, as well as borrowing ideas from others.
Leveraging the Pontifical Oriental Institute's advanced research facilities and cutting-edge technology, scholars were able to meticulously analyze and preserve critical historical documents.
There were certain documents that were in Persian. There was an Iranian student here doing a doctorate. So this is her father, Iraqi, was in an Iranian prison for 7 years during the war in the 1980s. She needed this guy's help to translate the Persian documents. They became the closest of friends. So, I mean, there's a whole story of both research and the reconciliation of peoples and cultures, carrying on a war today, things that had started centuries ago.